Cool, thanks. And thanks for inviting me here. I like PI a lot. So I'm going to talk about this fracton topological order. It's this new field in condensed matter. It's kind of a new kind of topological order, like torque code or Z2 gauge theory. But it goes beyond topological order in a very significant way. It'll depend on geometry in addition to topology. So torque code, it's kind of the easiest model of topological order. It's gapped, exactly solvable. It has these excitations, these E and M charge and flux excitations, which are on the ends of these string operators. Here's the Hamiltonian here. It's just a product of Z's along every plaquette and a product of X's on every cross. And so excitations, this operator we call fluxes, and these are charges. The model is stable to excitations, so you can break the gauge invariance and you still have topological order. Any perturbation you want to add, you still have a stable phase with a degeneracy equal to 4 in a torus. So you can use this for on a quantum computer to store your information robustly. I already talked about the topological excitations. And an important property of these models is they're topologically invariant. So if you braid some anions around each other, only the path that the anion takes matters. It doesn't matter. I'm sorry, only the topology of the path matters. It doesn't matter if you wiggle it a lot before you move it around. And the degeneracy only depends on the topology of the manifold you put the system on. This is in great contrast to these new kinds of orders, these fracton orders. So one of the interesting examples, our first examples, is Haas code. So here the model is also very simple. It's gapped, exactly solvable, stable to perturbations. Hamiltonian in this case is a little more complicated. We have two spins per site. Poly operator is Z or X. And so this is one term, the Hamiltonian, this is another term. Details aren't important. But the physics is very different. So now the degeneracy, it's no longer constant. So you put it on a cubic lattice with some system size L, the degeneracy will actually oscillate wildly with a system size L. And it'll go from 1, so non-degenerate, all the way up to almost 2 to the 8 L, so exponentially large in system size. So very useful if you want to store a lot of memory for a quantum computer. But what's more interesting is its excitations are these immobile fractons. So if you want to make excitations of the system, which are far away from each other, you no longer have these string operators like in torque code. Instead, you have to use these fractal-like operators. So you act with a bunch of poly operators along some fractal configuration, and that'll make 4 excitations on the corners of this fractal. And this actually also implies that these excitations can't move, because in torque code, if you want to move an excitation, you take an excitation and act with the string operator to move it. Now we don't have string operators, we just have these fractal operators, which create multiples of 4 fractons. So if you try and move a fracton, you can annihilate it, but you'll create 3 other fractons. So you can't move it without creating more excitations. And this is actually very useful for quantum computation because it can allow you to more robustly store information in your quantum computer. Because now your anions can't diffuse around your torus and flip a bit in your quantum memory. They'll be much less mobile. So you can think about this more carefully, and you can see that in order to create 2 distant fractons, the energy barrier you'll have to overcome is logarithmic in their distance. So for infinitely far apart fractons, it'll require an infinite amount of energy. Unfortunately, this isn't a big enough energy barrier to make this phase stable at finite temperature, so it's not, unfortunately, a self-correcting quantum memory, but it was a very amazing progress in this direction. And clearly, this model has no topological invariance like torque code because the degeneracy depends on system size. We have these very rigid operators to make our excitations. The model doesn't even have rotation invariance. This is one of the more complicated examples of fracton order, type 2, we call it. I like to think of it as like a fractal-like fracton order. But there's a much more simple example of fracton order that I'll talk about for the rest of this talk.
So sorry, it's thermal stability. Is there some simple way to understand this, like some Pyrrhel's argument, reaching the entropy balance that says that there's no finite temperature transition or something?
It has to do with this log isn't enough. Mm-hmm. If you have string operators, those are thermally stable because it requires, for a string of length r, the energy cost is linear in R.
Right.
But this isn't enough. So I'm going to talk about this X cube model. In this case, the fractons will be at corners of these flat membrane operators. So this is kind of like a special case of those fractal-like fracton orders, where now instead of some fractal dimension, we just have an integer fractal dimension. So it'll be much simpler. I'll also have gapped, exactly solvable, stable to perturbations. The degeneracy is going to be much simpler. It's just a simple exponential in system size. And the Hamiltonian's a lot easier to see pictorially. So one term is a product of Z operators along the edges of every cube in your lattice. So again, the Pauli degrees of freedom will live on the links of the lattice. And the other kind of term are these cross operators. So at each vertex, you have three cross operators. This is why they call it an X cube model, because one term's a cube, and one term's a looks like an X. This was introduced very recently by Sagar Vijay, Xiaomeng Ha, and Liang Fu just a year ago. That's very new stuff, but has some very interesting physics. And in this case, the excitations are a lot easier to understand. So if we act on the ground state with a membrane of X operators, so all these red links, I'm applying X operators on the ground state, that'll excite four fracton excitations at the corners of this membrane operator. So that's because like this X operator here will anti-commute with the Z operator of the fracton operator. So if once you act on the ground state with this membrane operator, the wave function is an eigenstate of this operator with eigenvalue minus one. That's an excitation because I had this minus sign here. So this is minus one, you have higher energy. So these membrane operators make fracton excitations at the corners. These are also immobile for a similar reason. If you try and move one of these fractons, you don't have string operators, you only have these membrane operators which make four fractons. So if you delete this fracton, you'll create three other fractons. So you can't move a single fracton excitation. Although you can imagine making this membrane taller, and so that tells you that you can move a pair of fractons. So it actually turns out if you have two fractons like this, they can move along a two-dimensional plane that's orthogonal to their displacement. So we call this a dimension two particle because it can move in two dimensions. The other kind of particle is a dimension one particle, also called a lineon. So if you imagine acting on the ground state with a product of Z operators on this blue string, so hopefully you've seen I have this color convention. Blue always means a Z operator, red will always mean an X operator. So if you act with Z operators along this string, this will create these lineon excitations at the end of the operator, so that's not too surprising. So this string operator will anti-commute with these operators in the Hamiltonian. But more interesting, at the corner of this line operator where it kinks, you also create excitations. So that means these lineons, they have to move in a straight direction. If they try and change direction, then it creates and leaves behind an excitation. So that's why we call it a dimension one particle. It can only move in one dimension. And all this is stable to perturbations. You add any perturbations to the model, none of this physics changes. So it's kind of the introduction to this talk. So it's a good time to ask questions. Are there any questions about the basic physics? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused by the statement that it's stable to all perturbations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you exactly mean by that?
So you can add any perturbations to the model, and you'll still have emergent dimension one particles, which can only move along straight lines. The fractons, they'll still be immobile. If you have an isolated fracton, it can't move. The degeneracy is stable to perturbations, just like torque code. You add perturbations to torque code. It doesn't mean you can now create just one excitation. You still have to create your charges in pairs and fluxes in pairs. And the Brayton statistics are still robust under perturbations. Is that the answer you're looking for, or?
Can you explain perhaps a little bit why? I mean, I can imagine all kinds of crazy excitations, right?
Mm-hmm. So there will be all kinds of crazy excitations, but there always exist. Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah,
any local perturbation.
Right, there must be some kind of locality restrictions, or
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, so the locality is important, yes. Any local perturbation.
Okay, exactly do you mean by local? I mean, that's how long is a piece of string question?
If you have some operator that has some size r, then its coefficient should decay as exponentially with its size. Any other questions so far?
Can this fractal and the linear can they talk to each other in some way?
Yes, you can braid them around each other and you'll get braiding statistics just like in Toric code. But fractons don't talk to fractons and lineons don't really talk to lineons. Mm-hmm.
Is this exhaustive? Are these all the excitations?
In this model, yes.
How do we know that?
Well, these are the only operators in this model to excite. So that's the only excitations. And a product, so each vertex has three of these cross operators. If you take the product of all three, you get one. So it also means you have to excite an even number of cross operators at each vertex. And
so you refer to the terms that appear in the Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying when you describe what happens when you act with these poly operators,
mm-hmm.
or in as a membrane,
mm-hmm.
and also what happens with the line of.
Mm-hmm.
Of
sigma
z.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of operators can be understood in terms of those.
Yeah. So there is some more stuff, like if you have two lineons that are parallel next to each other, they are a dimension two particle also, which can move along some plane, similar to how two pairs of fractons was a dimension two particle.
Sorry, can I just...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, please.
Maybe this is what the talk will be about, but
mm-hmm.
This membrane is a rectangle, right? Is it
mm-hmm.
important that it's a rectangle, or can I deform smoothly the...
No, you cannot deform. If you deform the rectangle, you'll create more fractons. So at every corner of the operator, you have a fracton.
So they move rigidly.
Yeah, they're very rigid operators.
And here in this line, so can you explain again? So this line can bend,
mm-hmm.
and whenever it bends, I create some excitation there, and then this excitation can slide along this line.
So this excitation over here, it's also dimension one particle, and it can move in the vertical direction, orthogonal to this line. It turns out, I'll talk about this a little bit more later, actually.
Is there, maybe this is, I think this was the title of the talk. So what's the, how do I think it in a field, in a continuous language of this?
Yeah, that'll be in the talk. We'll see that in, so normal field theories, like BF theory, you have a charge conservation constraint. In this case, the charge conservation constraint is generalized. It generalizes to mobility constraints. So the generalized charge conservation constraint will give you this mobility constraint. Cool. So the main goal of this talk will be to discuss how you describe this with a quantum field theory. So this is actually thought to be impossible for a while for a number of reasons. One of the most common reasons is the degeneracy will be infinite for an infinitely large lattice. So if you make a finer and finer lattice, in that limit, the degeneracy will go to infinity exponentially fast. So this seems like a problem. Another problem is how the heck do we write down the answer of the Lagrangian? Our favorite approach is to have a model with a lot of symmetry so we can just guess the answer because we can rule out a lot of terms. But here we don't even have rotation symmetry. So it's almost impossible to guess the answer. So we'll need a systematic approach. And then finally, if we have a field theory and a QFT, we should really be able to braid these particles and understand that from the quantum field theory. So I'll have to talk about that too. Question?
Too late to ask more questions.
Oh, please do.
So it's in relation to me. So are these ground states, there is exponential degeneracy.
Mm-hmm.
But how are the ground states connected? Are they connected through some amount of energy that...
So they're all degenerate, and there's logical operators just like Toric code.
Right, so you have to do something non-local to map from one ground state to another?
That's right. If you move a lineon around your torus, that'll flip a bit.
So is that a problem from the quantum field theory perspective? I mean, wouldn't we just be talking, we just need to focus on one ground state and excitations on top of it?
Yeah, the quantum field theory, just like BF theory, you can describe the different ground state manifolds.
But you mentioned this degeneracy, infinite
mm-hmm.
degeneracy as
mm-hmm.
an abstraction, potentially, to discussing a continuous version of this.
Right, so the answer is we'll have to add a cutoff in order to describe a finite ground state degeneracy in the field theory. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Yeah.
Cool, so yeah, that's the answer to the first question. If we add some cutoff little a, and if this is the physical system size, and that gives us a lattice size L, and then we can describe system with a finite degeneracy. So that's kind of our typical approach when we get an infinity in a field theory. Adding a cutoff is usually what you have to do. Because we already chose our UV description, so we can't just find another UV description. Our UV system is this system. And then, how do we write down the Lagrangian? It turns out there's actually a very close relationship between BF theory and toric code. And we can use this as inspiration to systematically derive a Lagrangian for the X cube model. So we'll see that soon. But first, we should talk about how do we braid these excitations. So suppose we have some fracton over here, which I made with this product of X operators on this rectangular membrane. So that's this picture over here. And I want to detect this by braiding excitations around it. So we can do this by braiding these Lyonian excitations, excitations of the cross operator. So it turns out these Lyonians have a very interesting fusion rule. You can create three Lyonians in three orthogonal directions from the vacuum. And you can see this because this product of Z operators along these three strings will commute with all these cross operators at this vertex. It's a very interesting geometric fusion rule. And so I can, now I've got these three Lyonians here and I want to move them around this cube. I can do this by just applying more X operators along the edges of some cube. So now I kind of repeat the last process three times and apply an operator like this. So it traces out the edges of a cube. And I can think of this as creating these triplets of Lyonians at four corners of the cube and moving them to the other four corners and annihilating them. And so this operator will pick up a non-trivial braiding statistic because it'll anti-commute over here at this intersection where it intersects with the membrane operator that created the fracton. And so we also see something very amazing. We're braiding point-like particles in 3D. Before this was thought to be impossible because you have string operators, there's no real way to non-trivially have some sort of topological invariant. But here we have an invariant because these anions, they have these mobility restrictions. So this membrane here, it was rigid. It can't be deformed to not pass through this blue line operator. And also this blue line operator, it was also rigid. It had to be straight. So if I had a fracton in the middle of this cube, its membrane is forced to intersect with the line operator of the cube. So these mobility restrictions allow us to do braiding of point particles in 3D. And it also gives us a physical understanding of what this cube operator in the Hamiltonian means, because here we just had a bigger cube operator. So the way this cube operator works is it braids Lyonians around the edges of the cube to count the number of fractons within the cube.
Now I'm lost again. So seen from far away, the small corner is a particle, right? This fracton that you said.
Yeah, the cube, yeah.
Where is the other particle? It's the blue big cube?
So the blue lines, oopsies, were string operators for the Lyonians. And at the ends of the string operator was a Lyonian. And once I make this entire cube, it's like a closed loop. So it doesn't create any excitations. This closed cube thing, it is telling us that a bunch of Lyonians went around these paths.
Each arrow is a Lyonian propagating.
Yes, exactly.
There are many, many of them.
There's just one Lyonian that went around. Or you can think about it different ways, but... yeah, there's only one Lyonian going through each line.
But the Lyonians have annihilated, so that blue path is, now there's no excitation.
That's right, yeah. So you started with vacuum, you made some excitations, and you always want to go back to the vacuum at the end of your braiding operation. And here we'll get a braiding statistic minus one because of this intersection.
You create three particles.
Mm-hmm.
Move them around and annihilate them back.
Exactly.
Can you tell me the path again? Where you create and what are the paths?
I can create them if I want a triplet here, a triplet here, a triplet here, and a triplet up there, and then move them to the other four corners of the cube. Here, 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 and up there.
You create four and then?
I create four sets of triplets and then annihilate them at four different points. You can do it in all kinds of ways. I could just start with three here, move one here, and have that split up into two, and go here, and so on. Just like if you want to braid a flux around a charge, I could just create two fluxes and braid them this way, Or I could take two fluxes here, move them halfway, take two fluxes here, move them halfway, and then annihilate them here. So you can interpret it different ways. Cool. So now suppose we want to detect a lineon vibrating fractons. So this could be a lot more challenging because these fractons were somewhat immobile. But remember, if we had two fractons, we could actually move them along a 2D plane. So let's see how this works. So suppose we have these four fractons at the corners of some membrane operator. So it's this picture up here. And now let's make this membrane operator a little bit bigger. So I'm going to extend it over here. And now that we're going to also have created two fractons here. So this is like a fracton dipole. And when I did this, this fracton could move to the right. So we see that a fracton can move if it's willing to emit a dipole of fractons. If this dipole continues up here, it can annihilate this guy and move him to the right. So now these two pairs of fractons move to the right by exchanging a fracton dipole. So we can watch that again. The bottom guy emits a fracton dipole. That dipole goes up, annihilates the guy here, and he moves. So now we have like a physical interpretation of this membrane operator. The membrane operator, which makes fractons at the corner, it's telling us the path that these dipoles moved in order to make the fractons and move them. Yes, yeah, so that's what I just said here. Cool, okay, so now we can think about how do we detect this lineon. So we've got some lineon, this red arrow thing, at the end of this blue string of Z operators. I can act with the membrane operator, this red operator, and that'll create four fractons here. And now I can do this again, have a membrane this way. So these fractons here were annihilated, but now I create two fractons here. And I do this again, another membrane operator, now I have two fractons here. And one more membrane operator to annihilate those fractons. So now I acted with this square-shaped membrane. And this will again give me some non-trivial statistic because it anti-commutes with the line operator right here. And this also gives us a physical interpretation of these cross operators in the Hamiltonian. So this cross operator is like taking a fracton dipole and moving it around this vertex and counting the number of lineons at that vertex.
Very basic confusion. Uh-huh. I thought the membranes needed to be in one of the directions. Can they be in any direction?
They can be in the XY plane, YZ plane, or XZ plane. Because we see I don't have the picture here, but they had to be orthogonal to the direction of one of the links. The other interesting thing is, if you just tell me where you move your fractons, that's not enough to uniquely specify a braiding statistic. Because I can imagine if I have periodic bounding conditions, I could exchange my fracton dipoles along the periodic direction, which means membrane operators like this. And now I don't have a non-trivial braiding statistic because now the membrane operator doesn't intersect the line operator. So this will be very important for the field theory. This means that when I have a current describing the fractons, my fracton current, it has to describe the membrane. It has to tell me where the fracton dipoles are moving. It's not just a current for the fractons. And so I told you about the braiding for the X-cube model on a cubic lattice. We have these like cube-shaped operators. But if you put the X-cube model on the different lattice, say the stack of Kagame lattices, you get different geometric shapes for your braiding operators. And these are rigid. You can't have these triangular shapes in the cubic lattice. You can't have these cubic shapes on a stacked Kagame lattice. So the lattice physics becomes very important in the IR for these phases. These phases are very sensitive to the UV physics. And also you can think about this Chaman model, a very old model of fracton order. It has these very interesting shapes. So here you also get fractons at corners of these membrane operators. And here the rigid braiding shapes of these operators are kind of complicated, but very interesting. And this is an example of how much geometry is going to play a role in these phases. Geometry becomes very important. And here's, I think, the easiest pictorial way to see this. This is also a good spot to ask for questions. Uh-huh.
What about the self-statistics?
In the X-cube model, there are no self-statistics. Makes it very simple. In the Chaman model, there are self-statistics. So this green, I meant is like a poly Y operator. So these lineons, since they have X, Y, and Z operators, they can anti-commute with each other, and it makes the Chaman model a lot harder to understand. But the XQ model doesn't have that, and that's very nice. Other questions?
Can you get non-abelian statistics with any of these models?
Yeah, that was a recent paper by Sagar Vijay. He had some non-abelian statistics in a fractal model. But it is definitely more difficult than like normal gauge theory. Cool, so now we can go on to the field theory. So let's review this connection between BF theory and toric code. So here's the toric code Hamiltonian, product of Z operators around a Paquette, or as cross of X operators. And this is described very nicely by this topologically invariant BF theory, which looks like this. So if you generalize toric code to Zn operators, you have this N in the Lagrangian, and then you have these two fields, A and B. A is a gauge field, and so is B. B is kind of like an electric field, like an electric field. And we call it BF theory because it's B times F, where F is this del A. So that's why they call it BF theory. And we can see the connection to toric code by expanding the Lagrangian out in space and time coordinates, because the Hamiltonian is not Lorentz invariant, so we're not going to be able to see this connection until we ruin the Lorentz invariants. So here I've taken the BF theory Lagrangian and expanded it out. So here, these Greek letters are space-time coordinates, so they can be 0, 1, or 2. But the Roman letter is just 1 or 2, so the Roman letters are spatial coordinates. So the first term, Lagrangian, is telling us that A and B are conjugate fields. You can think about this as like if you're trying to normal order a bunch of X and Z operators, you'll get a bunch of minus signs as you move Z operators past the X operators. And that's basically what this term is telling you. So this A field, it's related to the Z operator, and the B field is related to the X operator. You also see this if you do like a field theory of the harmonic oscillator, you'll see some term like P del T X. So again, conjugate fields. The next term, it's like a curl of the A field. And so that's like a continuum version of this discrete lattice of Paquette operator. This square is like a curl. And then this B naught field is like a Lagrange multiplier, saying that this term is zero, which is to say there are no excitations or flux excitations in the ground state Hilbert space. And the next term is similar. So now this is also curl of the B field, but if you write the B field in terms of some other field X like this, which is related to these X operators, then this becomes kind of like a divergence. And so this term is like a divergence, which is like this lattice plus operator. It's like a discretized version of a divergence. And the time component of the A field is also a Lagrange multiplier, which says you have no charges in the ground state Hilbert space. So this is kind of the relationship that we want to use to try and understand how to derive a field theory from the X-cube model. All right, so let's do this. So we're going to have, again, these fields A and B. B will be a symmetric field with two components, and A is just one component again. The fact that you have two indices for B isn't really that physically important. Since it's symmetric, I could just have one index, kind of like I define it down here. So I can be symmetric with two spatial indices or just one spatial indice. It's just a matter of convention or notation. So again, these will be conjugate fields. But what's more interesting is trying to understand these two terms. I have a slide for this. So this fracton operator, this cube, you can generalize the X cube model to Zn, in which case you have different directionalities for the links. And so this cube is kind of like a discretized version of this term, it turns out. So it's like this double derivative of the A field. So if you think one derivative on, let's say, C is 3 and B is 2, so it's like a Y derivative of AZ. So it's like this link minus this link. And then A will have to be 1 because we have this Levi-Civita, say A, B, and C are different. So now we have another derivative that these two links minus these two links. And that gives us these vertical links of this cube. And then in the other three directions, we get the other 8 links. So this cube operator is like a lattice discretization of this derivative thing. Question?
So why doesn't this term vanish? The derivative.
Because I took the absolute value of the Levi-Civita tensor. So normally we have Lorentz invariants. So you never have absolute values of Levi-Civita tensors. But here, we don't even have rotation invariants. So there's nothing wrong with a term like this. This is just the easiest way to write this term. And we can do the same kind of game for the other term. Oh, so I'm sorry. So here, the B-naught is a time component, and it's the Lagrange multiplier saying you have no fractons in the ground state. We can describe these cross terms in a similar way. Rewrite this B field in terms of an X field, and then it looks like a kind of funky kind of divergence, which is perpendicular to one direction. That gives us a term like this. And again, there's a Lagrange multiplier. Actually, there's three of them, because we have three different kinds of cross operators. So we'll need three different kinds of Lagrange multipliers, saying that all these excitations are zero in the ground state. And also notice there's no typo here. This A appeared three times. Again, there's no Lorentz invariance, no rotation invariance, so there's nothing wrong with that. So I'm just implicitly summing over all A, B, and C equals 1, 2, and 3 in this equation. There's no typo.
Why is there no absolute value there?
In this case, you don't need it. And you don't want it to, if you want to match up with this operator here.
Isn't that term 0? You mentioned that B is a symmetric.
B is symmetric, but you see I have this A here, and it appears here. So it appeared three times, so it doesn't cancel out. It's kind of funky. So yeah, unfortunately, a lot of our old intuition of things canceling is a lot harder when you have triple indices. That's just what's necessary to describe this. Oh, so this is the Lagrangian to describe this. And it's a little messy, but we can understand some interesting things from it. So let's review how we understand conserved charges and BF theory. So if you couple BF theory to these sources, J and I, so J is your source for your charge, and I is your source for your flux. Since these lattice operators in your Hamiltonian commute, that implies that you have this gauge invariance. It's kind of an interesting connection there. And the gauge invariance is that A goes to some divergence of a scalar and B goes to a divergence of some different scalar. So you have two gauge invariances. And this gives you conserved charge. Your charge is conserved and your flux is conserved. Because if you want your Lagrangian to be invariant under this gauge transformation, you have to have this constraint for your sources in order for these two terms to be invariant. So we can do the same thing for the X cube model. So we have this Lagrangian here. You can systematically calculate a gauge invariance. I'll show how to do this in the paper. It turns out these are the equations. And now we can couple this Lagrangian to sources, I and J. So A will couple to J and B will couple to I. And we can ask that the Lagrangian is invariant under the gauge symmetry. And these are the equations we get for what the sources have to obey. And you can think about this a lot, and you can find that this is actually mobility constraints in addition to charge conservation constraints. So this equation here can actually tell you that the fracton can't move, and this equation here tells us that this J operator describes dimension one particles that move in a line, or that they can have this crazy fusion rule where it can create three from the vacuum.
So why is A zero semicolon A?
Yeah, I could have just erased the zero semicolon. I added the zero semicolon to tell you that it's like a time component.
So in your log, how many fields do you have?
So I have three A fields and three B fields. Oh, and then these time components. So there's one time component for B and three time components for A. So A has six field total and B is 4 fields total.
So the semicolon is not the usual covariant derivative.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, that's right. Yes. Very sorry.
So B is an anti-symmetric.
That's right. Oh, it's symmetric. B is symmetric.
So B is symmetric. Mm-hmm. And A is just vector field.
Yeah. We don't have rotation symmetry, so maybe you don't want to call it a vector, but yes.
that be coupled to some membrane source? Is that or?
Right. That you'll have to use membrane sources to make fractons, to make this fracton density. We worked this out in the paper, but it was too mathy for a presentation, I thought. But yeah, if you're interested, look at our paper. We work it out very explicitly and give simple equations. Other questions?
So in the last equation,
mm-hmm.
there's a free index B there, or there is a typo.
Oh, yes, thank you. No typo again. B appears once, C appears three times. And we're not summing over A, so this is an equation for all A's. So fix A, but implicitly sum over B and C. And again, you're allowed to do this because there's no Lorentz invariance that forces us to not have these funky things. And so this is just notation, this is the simplest notation. I could have expanded it out, it would have been ugly. Question?
Okay, so if your semicolon doesn't mean the usual thing, what does it mean?
It just means nothing. I could have erased it, that would have been fine. Maybe I should have done that.
It's too late now.
So A0 transforms into A0 plus time derivative sum.
That's right, some vector. So just with spatial components only. So it has three components, 1, 2, and 3. And B, there's a scalar. So B not to some time component of a scalar, time derivative of a scalar. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate the analogy with a BF and the tonic code, but in that case you end up with some field theory,
mm-hmm.
that the field theory is a mess. Mm-hmm. Not because they are used to it, but
mm-hmm.
because it looks like a, there is a freedom in the continuum.
Mm-hmm.
What you have here, is it also the use of freedom in the continuum? I mean, that's the claim, right?
Yeah.
But are these degrees of freedom just constrained in such a way that when we discretize, we get what we had?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else, is there any simplified description that appears in the continuum?
The continuum and the lattice version are very closely connected, just like BF theory and toric code. So which is simpler to you might be a matter of tastes. But I definitely did learn a lot about the lattice from thinking about the field theory.
But will we, in the continuum, is there any symmetry that emerges that was not on the lattice?
Oh yes, you're right. We have some subgroup of the conformal group. It's not in the slides, but if you take the x-coordinate, it can be transformed into some function of the x-coordinate, and y to some other function of the y-coordinate, and similarly z to some function of z, and t to some function of t. So that's something you can't see on the lattice, but the field theory actually has that invariance.
You said conformal?
It's a subgroup of the conformal group.
Okay. So it's not diffeomorphisms, generic, in one direction, but...
So the direction was important, so x goes to a function of x. But not like vector goes to function of vector. That would be like a diffeomorphism invariance.
You have to do this transformation simultaneously on all the coordinates.
That's right.
How many fields are there now? I count 6 A fields and 7 B fields.
B only had 4 independent fields because this is a symmetric. Oh, I'm sorry. So B is symmetric, but also it's off diagonal. So it's off diagonal symmetric.
Okay.
So you have 3 plus 1. Yeah.
4 and 6 A fields.
Exactly.
I have the same question here. So now you have some symmetries that only appear in the continuum.
Mm-hmm.
Are there implications for the model, for the low energy physics of this model?
A little bit. So in a future work, we'll see that the X cube model is, so this is future work with like Zi Chen, our grad student. And so if you take the X cube model in some lattice, you can also add these toric codes. And that's, you can now apply a local unitary transformation to sew those toric codes onto the X cube model and increase the lattice size. So this is kind of how you can see scale invariance in this model. So no longer, you can't just add trivial qubits to do some scale transformation. You have to add toric codes to do a scale transformation. Cool, okay, so now we can talk about the ground state degeneracy. So in toric code, we can understand this degeneracy four in a torus using the logical operators. So you can take a charge and wrap it around the torus, and that gives you this Wilson loop, product of Z operators. That'll anti-commute with the string of the flux, product of X operators. And this shows you that you have a degenerate ground state Hilbert space where this Wilson loop is like acting like a logical poly Z operator on your ground state Hilbert space. And this loop is like a logical X operator on your ground state Hilbert space. So this XQ model has something similar. We also have these Wilson loops described by dimension one particles that move along straight lines. Well, these now they can't bend, these Wilson loops, these blue loops, they have to be straight. And so it looks like, okay, you only have one non-contractible loop. But actually, if you start from a different point, you know, if you translate the loop, that's a different loop because they can't deform. But there is some redundancy, because if you take a stack of these cube operators, multiply them together, that means that if you have four loops, they have to have eigenvalue one. And if you look at, okay, so what are the non-equivalent logical operators? You get a non-equivalent one for every point on this blue line on the bottom here, and draw a logical operator, Wilson loop going vertical. That gives you an independent operator. And the length of this line is L, this line is L, but then we have some redundancy here. So we get 2L minus 1 logical operators for the Wilson loop. And you also get this in three other directions. That gives you this 2 to the 6L minus 3 degeneracy. Also, it's very interesting. Normally, you have this duality, dimensional duality of your logical operators. So in 3D, you have string operators. That means you also have membrane operators. So the dimension of the two operators sums to the dimension of your manifold. Here, that doesn't hold. We just have string operators in this 3D system. This, again, comes from the mobility constraints. So this blue operator has to be a straight line, and the red to hoof loop, it's a dimension two particle. It can move along a plane, but in the plane, that always has to intersect this line. So these loops will always be forced to intersect each other, no matter how you deform them.
I have a stupid question. So you're putting the model on a cube. What are the boundary conditions on the face of the cube?
In this case, it's periodic. I'm sorry.
Okay, so the degeneracy in here doesn't depend actually on the genus of the surface you're putting it in?
It depends on more than just the genus.
Okay, so if I can put it on a G genus surface, then that degeneracy will be even higher.
It can be kind of complicated. The degeneracy depends very strongly on system size, and then the topology of the manifold can affect this number here, but also a lot can affect this number here. So a lot more than just the genus becomes important. That's actually new work. Unpublished work is putting this model on different lattices with different topologies. That's not on the archive yet, but it should be soon. Some more interesting physics occurs. You actually can have a stable, robust degeneracy just from geometry or spatial curvature on the lattice. So if you imagine starting with the 2D square lattice, you can add some little bump to it.
Sorry,
and
just a very naive question. Mm-hmm. Here we are discussing your model, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't the red thing two-dimensional? Now it looks like a line. I'm just lost with the red thing. Weren't they breaking?
This slide? Yeah, well, I haven't described this yet.
But even in the previous one, now they look like lines. I thought before they were brains, the red things.
Oh, yeah. So this is just like a membrane that's very, very narrow. So you can make the membrane as narrow as you want. And now it's just describing like a pair of fractons moving.
So each membrane has four fractons at the four tips?
That's right.
Oh, I see.
If you make the membrane very small, then it's like moving pairs of fractons, which can move along a 2D plane. Right. So if you make a little bump in your square lattice, you'll be adding disclination defects at these colored plaquettes, so some curvature defect. And naturally, if you want each square to be the same volume, you'll want to add these green links to your lattice. This is kind of like a 2D warm-up example of adding curvature to a 2D square lattice. If we take the cubic lattice and make a bump the size of a solid torus, so we kind of, and this bump is extending into a fourth direction, fourth dimension, so I can't really draw it. But I can draw the green links that you might add to the cubic lattice, and that'll take the shape of a torus. And in the XCube model, this will kind of act as like an emergent like toric code on this torus. And this will give you some topological robust degeneracy on this curved region in your cubic lattice. We can also see even more interesting geometry. So if you consider putting the XCube model on this slanted cubic lattice, or this cubic lattice with a different slant, or a stack of Kagame lattices, or a cubic lattice with the larger unit cell, all of these lattices will give you a different phase of matter. So if you try and use some local unitary, maybe add trivial qubits, and try and use a local unitary to connect ground states of these different lattices, you won't be able to do that with a local unitary. Or if you add, you know, more degrees of freedom so that they all live on the same lattice with the same number of poly operators, but put the XCube model on the black lattice and just have trivial qubits on the pink lattice, and try and interpolate this Hamiltonian to this Hamiltonian, you'll have to go through a phase transition. So the XCube model on different lattices corresponds to different phases of matter, which have to be separated by phase transitions, which is very different from like toric code. Toric code on triangle lattice, square lattice, they're the same phase. But that's not true for these interesting fractine orders. Since I'm at PI, I should mention some interesting connections to gravity, or at least gravity-like physics. It's not really gravity. So like a decade ago, my advisor and some other gentlemen tried and come up with lattice models of linearized gravity. We now understand that these are actually gapless U1 models of fracton topological order. So that's very interesting. You try and come up with a simple model of gravity, you just get fractons. And maybe it's not too surprising because we see that fractons have a very strong dependence on geometry. So our ultimate, you know, geometric gravity models should have some connection. And indeed, Michael Precto found that there is some mechanism for some sort of gravity-like attraction between fractons. Because we saw that fractons, they can move by exchanging fracton dipoles with other fractons. So if I have a lot of fractons here, that means one fracton can move faster if it's near a clump of other fractons, because it's easier to exchange dipoles with those fractons. And if you can move faster somewhere, that means you'll want to be closer to it, and there'll be a gravitational attraction. So that gives you some sort of gravitational mechanism for these fractons. And we can also consider putting this X-cube model on a curved space, like this curved hyperbolic space. In this case, the lineons inherit the geometry of the lattice. So the lineon will have to go along these curved, curved lines. So they basically follow the geodesics of the lattice, the manifold. And that's, you know, it's not that they, that's just what their equations of motion says that they do. They are constrained, you know, their gauge invariant says that they must go along these lines. And maybe this gives you some very simple way to see some very simple ADS-CFT correspondence, not like a, you know, no string theory, but maybe a very simplified version. Because we have this gapped geometric bulk of the XCube model, and we have these lineon Wilson loops, and they are like sort of degenerate, because in general their energy excitation will be exponentially small in the length of the line. The length of the line is only logarithmic in distance, so you get some polynomial scaling for the gap for some distance between points. And so it seems like you can get some sort of long-range gapless correlations on the boundary of the X-cube model on this hyperbolic space. So if you're interested in studying this and you like ADS-CFT and you're not afraid of lattice models, I'd be interested in talking more about this with you some other time. But so now we can talk about some more realistic stuff before we conclude. So if you want to come up with, you know, maybe some material with this X-cube model, how would you do this? So recently, me and Yumbek, and also Tim Shea with Gabor and Leon, we've all come up with some two-spin models. So with this X-cube model, or actually they came up with a bunch of models of different fracton orders. So now it's just two spin models. So all the operators in the Hamiltonian only involve two poly operators. So this shows that in principle, you might be able to have some material disorder. Because in realistic materials, you can't have 12 spin operators in the Hamiltonian. Two spin is much more common. And then as of today, we also have this very interesting duality between non-compact U1 fractons. So I didn't talk about this in this talk, but there are these gapless U1 fracton models. If the U1 is non-compact, there's a duality between disclinations and lattices. So a disclination in a lattice is also immobile. So here we're considering 2D models. So in a 2D lattice, a disclination is not mobile, just like a fracton is not mobile. But a dislocation, which is like two disclinations of opposite signs, those are mobile, just like a fracton dipole is mobile. And then the phonons of the lattice are like the gauge modes, which are gapless in these U1 fracton theories. And then you can also relate the strain tensor to the electric field of the fracton theory, the magnetic field of the fracton theory, the lattice momentum. This is recent work by these gentlemen that just appeared on the archive today. So I had a very fun time reading this last night. It's really cool. Cool, so that's my talk. I hope I've convinced you that these fracton models, they go beyond topological order and have this very interesting dependence on geometry. And I think this warrants a lot of very interesting further study. Thank you. Question?
Yeah, so I'm confused about something you mentioned at the beginning, that this X-cube model is robust against local perturbations, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, most of the ground state properties depend on the geometry. So if I have a local perturbation, that's like a local deformation of the geometry,
mm-hmm.
right? So how can I understand that those perturbations do not affect anything of the ground state, even though there's a high dependence on the geometry?
Right, so for example, when you make this torus-shaped curvature, if the torus is very small, you'll have an energy, so the energy splitting for this ground state degeneracy is exponentially small in the size of the torus. So if the torus is small, you don't really have a ground state degeneracy. But if the torus is large, your exponential splitting of the degeneracy is very small. So you only get stable properties when your curvature regions are very large. So you needed to form a large part of your lattice to get some topologically protected property. Oh.
Is there a 4D analogy that's fault tolerant?
Well, 4D torque code is already fault tolerant.
Yeah, because I can imagine you taking your fracton operator and your line ions and making the
mm-hmm.
membrane ions or something like that.
Because mm-hmm.
like it's like the codimension of the defect boundary that has to be greater than one.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So.
But in here, actually, we kind of made it worse because in normal 3D torque code, you have membranes and lines, but now we just have two lines.
Yeah.
So this actually goes in the wrong direction if you want stable quantum memory, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So regarding your field theory, so could you explain how those gauge fields couple to the excitations of the fractal model? And you also mentioned that this gauge invariance implies the mobility constraint, but can you explain?
The second question is harder to explain, but the first one, so the A field is coupled to J, so this term here, the time component, is like the density of the line ions, and here the time component of I is the density of the fractons, and the spatial components of I and J, those are kind of like applying the membrane or string operators to move the excitations around. So if you've got I, it's non-zero on some surface, then that gives you, due to this constraint, you'll have to have this non-zero. So if you imagine I is like delta functions, so that it's non-zero on some rectangle, you have these two derivatives, they'll pick up a non-zero component at the corners of the rectangle. And so that means that I will have to be, you know, if you also have this, you have to add some time component here, that means you'll have to add fractons at that instant. That's probably better understood from looking at the equations in the paper.
I, A, B, can I view it as a membrane density?
Yes.
And, okay. that equation just tells you at the corner of the membrane there is a density of pi zero.
Yeah.
Then the last equation is?
So that's kind of similar. So J, it's like these line operators. So JC, the spatial component, is like a line operator. And then at the end, you know, we get this delta derivative, or this derivative will pick up where it ends. You'll have to, actually, you have to make two of these J excitations. Just like in the XQ model, you excited two cross operators. Here, two of these will get excited. And so if the one and two components of J are excited, that means you have a Z direction dimension one particle.
So regarding both I0 and IAB represent density of point-like particle and membrane.
Mm-hmm.
So there must be column associated with it.
What?
Is there a column?
Current. Oh, yeah. This is the current.
So what is the column for IAB?
IAB.
You said that's the density.
Oh, so that's the current of the fracton dipoles.
Current of fracton dipole.
Mm-hmm. And JC is the current for the dimension one particle.
Okay, and how do they couple to the gauge field?
So like I naught will couple to B0, mm-hmm. and IAB couples to BAB, JC couples to AC, and J0A couples to A0A.
Just linearly,
yeah.
Then you're saying the gauge invariance in the second meter implies the constraint for those.
Yes, correct.
That is the mobility constraint.
Mm-hmm. So if you have non-compact U1 fractons, the recent paper from today is an example. Michael also has two papers describing a gapped fracton model in 2D, but only with the field theory, not a lattice model. So to me, it's actually unclear whether or not this field theory is stable. So to me, that's not known for certain, but that's an example of what you're asking.
No more further questions. Let's thank Kevin again.